And once again, Mr. Steve Buchanan for the sermon.
This very nice card has been put together by Sheila for the roads. If you care to sign it afterwards, then I know that would be very much appreciated. Thank you for doing that, Sheila, and I'll get that back to the information table. Well, I will give a warning that today's message may eclipse my normal period of time. I'm of the firm belief that sermons ought to be about 50 to 55 minutes. Probably very rarely should they go further than that, or do they need to go further than that. But this particular time, on this particular topic, I realize that, you know, sometimes I go really fast giving the scripture. So, number one, I may go a little bit past that. I don't really know how far I went in, how long I spoke in Sierra Vista today, because I didn't time myself. I will time myself today. But since I've gone too fast sometimes for people to keep up, that I thought, well, I won't put my scriptures into my notes. I'll turn along with you. So that's one thing that's going to slow me down. The other thing is that it probably is a topic that could be covered in two messages, but by the time I finished it, I realized I don't really have enough time to split this up, and, you know, why leave people hanging for 2 weeks? And so without having a sermonette, yeah, you should be fine. So that's just my opinion, but I haven't even counted the number of scriptures here. I'm probably not going to compete even closely with the record set in Tucson circa 1992 by Mr. Tanner. 47 scriptures, as counted by my son and Greg Drury. At least they were paying attention and listening, and that's what kept them captivated. Didn't know you had the record, did you? Well, okay. Well, as you woke up this morning, there was crisis in Syria, Iran, threats to the entire world are seemingly always a present danger, certainly to the economic security of the entire world, not just the United States. And we can be consumed with what happens in our country today. And yet, under the surface, and perhaps at this very time, not to be too melodramatic about it, there are forces that are at or will shortly be in force that will dwarf the problems that we talk about every day in our government, our economy, our politics, our society today. Because on the horizon, whether it's near or distant, are a series of prophecies that contain some odd and even terrifying language that have puzzled Bible students for millennia. Now, since you became a Bible student, it hasn't really puzzled you, but I'll just say that this is a puzzlement to many people. So what I'd like to explore with you today is what the Bible says about the beast. That sounds scary just by itself, doesn't it? The beast! Who was and who will be the beast of Daniel and Revelation? And what will be, and the second part of the sermon is going to be, what is likely to be the characteristic of the modern beast that is yet to arise on the scene? The answers to these questions have always given God's people guideposts of prophecy. So we begin in the book of Revelation in chapter 13, because pertinent to this particular topic is a very important and little understood among many people, by the way, little understood Bible clue that helps us to understand who and what. Maybe it's a what. What is this beast? Who is this beast? How can this arise? How can it happen? Why does the Bible use this kind of language? But we have identified for many years what is called the mark of the beast. And the Bible reveals its own signs. So what is and what will be this mysterious mark of the beast? Years ago, I was giving a Bible study and a Bible study series in Rapid City on the topic of the book of Revelation. And we'd cover a couple of chapters at a time. And one of the men in the church came up to me excitedly with a news clipping clutched in his hands from the Rapid City Journal because he had discovered who the beast was. And the beast was a supercomputer that had just been written about in Belgium, the capital city of Belgium, probably a Cray supercomputer, which basically has the computing power that is about half of what my cell phone is right now, by the way. But it was at that time that this powerful supercomputer would be able to track every single individual on the face of the earth and give them the mark of this beast, which was a super powerful computer that finally had the capacity, when they had computers, by the way, that stored their information on, you know, almost reel-to-reel type things, and basically the supercomputers took up a space about twice the size of this building, now which is eclipsed by the power of this phone and its computing power and internet access. Sadly, I had to turn him away and say, don't think that's the beast or the identifying sign or going to be giving anybody the mark of the beast or any such thing. I hated to spoil the party for him at that particular time. Revelation 13 and verse 16. Now, have I given you enough time to turn to this? While I'm talking about this, I'm going to tell you this, that primarily we will be in the books of Revelation and the books of Daniel. And I'll skip back and forth, and you'll say, why didn't he just stay in the place where he was and blah, blah, blah? Well, I can't really answer that question. I don't know. It's just the way it worked out, okay? But it gives us all something to do while we're pondering the next sentence. Verse 16 says, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive the mark on their right hand or on their forehead. So what's going to happen here? Bible scholars have postulated this beast power is going to be able to brand people, just physically brand people. And as time went on, and, you know, it wasn't the branding of the Old West, and people realized probably it's not going to be a brand that's a heated thing. You know, all mankind is not going to be branded with a branding iron. Then it became some kind of, you know, as technology became more and more advanced, it would be some kind of thing that, you know, like a super identity. I don't even bring my wallet in here. Like a driver's license card. Everybody's going to be issued this national identity card, and that is going to identify you. You're going to be able to be traced wherever you are, blah, blah, blah. That was another kind of woebegone cockamamie theory that people had about the mark of the beast and how it causes this sign of identification for everybody. It says in verse 17 that no one may buy or sell except one who has this mark. You gotta have that credit card or that identity card, you see. If you don't have that, and it'll be issued, and when they do the census, or, you know, people come up with crazy ideas, you'll have to go down to your local commissar or county commissioner or whatever, and you'll be issued this like a driver's license. I wouldn't hold my breath on that one. No one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So mark, name, number. Mark, name, number. Pretty easy to remember all of these significant things. This chapter, chapter 13, I've broken into it, into the middle of it or towards the end of it. It is talking about a revival of an empire, a revival of an empire that is well known to historians, an empire that was labeled the Holy Roman Empire. But if you look into history, you'll find that this empire is pretty Roman, but it is not so holy at all. And yet people think it is. So this mark is a mark of a Roman Empire. And as John is on the Isle of Patmos, looking far out into the future, he is looking into our time and beyond. Our time and beyond about what is going to happen towards the time prior to Christ's return. We know that. We know that chapter 1 identifies his time period that he is looking into and being inspired to see and vision as the time prior to Christ's return and after Christ's return, and then for 1,000 years after that time, and then for hundreds of years perhaps after that time, and then into eternity as well. The whole book covers that particular time. But it says that there is a power here that causes the world to receive this mark, and it'll have the approval of the world. But some, it indicates, will not be able to buy or sell because they won't have the mark. So, sounds like a good thing to have. No. The ability to do business or hold a job or to enact in commerce is going to be affected by this mark of the beast. Now, Revelation 17 and in verse 6, it says, I saw the woman, which we'll identify a little bit later as well, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, intoxicated with the killing of individual saints. And we know what a saint is. Other groups think a saint is somebody that's been dead 300 or 400 years and has performed at least 3 spectacular miracles and has been well documented, and that person is a saint. And obviously in that church, not too many of those people that are canonized as saints and set apart as saints. I have a few every so often, but you know, they look into them, but that's not what the Bible describes as a saint. A saint is a called, chosen, converted son, daughter of God, plain and simple. So this woman, there is a woman here. And who is this woman? But whoever she is intoxicated. She is totally drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. But the angel said to me, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. So this woman is carried, sits on top of a beast. There is a future martyrdom of saints, as the Bible describes. But there has also been martyrdom, as we'll find out, of saints in the past. Now, how would these saints, past, present, or future, be identified? They don't have any mark on them that identifies them, but they are identified in some way. How are they identified? Revelation chapter 20 and in verse 4, it says of those individuals that they have not received a mark. They have not received this mark that is all important to know exactly what it is, because you want to avoid that mark at all costs. Judging by now, if you hear about blood and martyrdom and, you know, intoxication of a woman who's killing people, and they're only killing people without the mark, you kind of want to know, your interest might be piqued a little bit to know what it is. Verse 4 says, I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshiped the beast. There's that beast again. Or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. These individuals will be individuals that obey God rather than men, because they're not going to worship this beast. And you pretty soon get the idea of going through Revelation 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, that this beast is not such a good thing. So these individuals have refused this mark, and they will not join in the worship, as we'll see that woman is a type of church. And this woman that rides the beast is a future church that is a church that will in the future arise to prominence, greater prominence than it is now, and it will help enforce that mark of the beast. But these individuals who are mentioned in the first resurrection obey God. They don't obey man. They will not conform to the customs and traditions of this beast or the woman that is sitting on top. Now, you might say, has it ever happened that a state has enforced religion on people? And the answer is, yes, there is. Anciently speaking, go back to the book of Daniel. This is our first foray back to Daniel, and I'll warn you, of course, hold your place in this particular chapter for me, or this particular book for me. I will use the lovely card to hold my place because I'll be coming back here. But in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 4, we find that King Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2 makes this incredible image of himself, so as the people of Babylon will worship him and worship his image. And everyone is commanded, as we know from this chapter, to worship this image and to bow down to it. And it is a worship. But there are individuals, four to be specific, who are captives of Babylon, who are Jews, who would not submit. And there are others probably as well, who would not submit to that. And so after, even though Nebuchadnezzar had made this a decree, and you followed the king or you died, it says in verse 4, then a herald cried about aloud, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You know, false religions have all kinds of pageantry and all kinds of beautiful music sometimes associated with them, as this undoubtedly was. And the penalty was, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And you know what happened? Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to do this, and they were cast into the fiery furnace. And yet their lives were preserved. And Nebuchadnezzar was stunned, as we know. But this is a forerunner of the power and the might that we have never experienced. We have never physically experienced this kind of state-enforced religion in our lives. And in fact, that's anathema to Americans and to our Constitution and everything else that we in the last 200 years have grown up to celebrate and lived and been taught and everything else. It's a foreign concept to us. We can't imagine a national power forcing people to worship in a certain way. And yet it happened in ancient Babylon. And who did they worship? They were to worship the false god of Nebuchadnezzar. Because before God was finished with him, he helped him to understand that there is a Most High and that he was just a man. And that he was changed, his heart was changed to what? A beast. Like a beast for 7 years, and he was out in the wilderness, and he was out roaming around with long hair and nails and everything else, and until finally he came to them. Gives us a clue as to what the beast and who the beast will be. So, this is a forerunner of state-enforced religion. Now, back in Revelation chapter 14, and in verse 9, we read about what is going to happen at the end of the age. It says, then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And then you wonder why, in chapter 16, men refuse to believe God and they're angry at God, because this is what is going to be their fate for following the beast and accepting the mark on their forehead and on their hand, because they've had it enforced upon them, and because they're deceived, and because there will be miracles and lying wonders, as it says in Revelation 13. You may think we're covering a lot of scriptures today. We kind of are, but there's so much more you can do on your own. That's my hope, is that you'll be inspired to read and study a little bit on your own regarding this. This is serious, serious business. Verse 11 says, the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast in his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. There will be people spared, obviously. Now, I don't know how long ago it's been since I gave a message here on Revelation 11. It may have been a year ago. It was not too long ago in El Paso that I discussed the work of the two witnesses. And it's not that you needed to hear that sermon in order to be able to correctly understand this, because I'll cover it briefly. But Revelation 11, which I am not turning to, nor should you feel the need to do so, Revelation 11 talks about the work of these two witnesses. And these two individuals are going to be prophesying on the earth for 3.5 years, as we know. And what a great work they will do during that time. Revelation 11 shows that they are going to perform signs and miracles. Well, maybe I will turn to Revelation 11. Okay, permission granted to go to Revelation 11. It says in verse 4 that these are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. Similar language is mentioned in the book of Zechariah. If anyone wants to harm them, fire proceeds from their mouth and devours their enemies. And if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in this manner. You want to go against the two witnesses, good luck. You're not going to survive. It says, these have power to shut heaven so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy. Has that ever happened in the Bible before? Can you ever think of an instance in which that has happened? Sure you can. Elijah did the same thing, right? But it says, and they have the power over waters to turn them to blood and to strike the earth with all plagues as often as they desire. Now, have those things ever happened in the Bible? And obviously, every one of you know that this happened during the time of Moses. What has that got to do with anything? We'll turn to Malachi chapter 4 and verse 4. We've thought a lot about this particular passage through the years, but this seems to be, in my view anyway, it's just my opinion. I don't know that we've ever written on it or talked about it. This seems to fit the best based on this mark of the beast mystery that we're attacking, first of all, on who and what is the beast. Malachi chapter 4 and verse 4 says, remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and the judgments. Behold, I send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to their father, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse. I do have a very strong conviction that there are many people who have heard the message of God, people who have been a part of the church of God who are no longer, who will eventually be turned again to this message, because the message of the gospel of the kingdom of God is, if nothing else, a message of reconciliation. There are parables I could quote, many different things, but I submit to you that there are reasons for those stories. There are reasons for those things, and I think that it's very possible that we'd better be ready at some point in the future, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, or whether we're here or wherever we are, to welcome people back with open arms, to have a reunion of people who have been called of God and maybe for a while have not responded. Just a personal idea. This is the work that is described, in my view, in chapter 11. I don't think we've ever written on it or talked about it or anything, and maybe it could be classified as under the term of Buchanan's speculation. But certainly, if there is not a preserved truth of God, then there's no reason not to smite the earth with a curse. There have to be people who have belief and who have understanding and who have the knowledge of God. And in that previous sermon that I mentioned, I talked about the fact that, in coordinating these two passages, you can't understand God or his plan unless you understand the holy days and what they represent. And I believe that that is going to be part of the teaching of these two witnesses during that time. I don't know how big a part, but unless you are adequately prepared and given that knowledge, you could always say, you didn't really explain it. You know, what is God doing? You didn't really make the clarification. You didn't really make the distinction between the true church and the false church. I think it's going to be made abundantly clear what the Bible teaches. And let's face it, the things that really set us apart are the understanding of the plan of God. And the only reason you understand the plan of God, or I understand the plan of God from Passover to last great day, is because of all of those holy days there and in between. We do not understand God fully or his plan for us. We can't even really understand the book of Revelation totally unless you understand the holy days. It all fits together perfectly. And what does it say? That it says, remember the law of Moses, my servant, with the statutes and the judgments. The holy days are part of the statutes. And of course, there are the commandments. Now, turn to Revelation chapter 15. This is a very interesting chapter, I think, because not only do we realize that the Apostle John has been transported forward into time, thousands of years from where he is, let's just speculate and say 2,000 years from where he is on the Isle of Patmos now, but in the midst of this prophecy, he projects again further into the future, even past the day of the Lord. And you have to understand that to really understand the passage itself. He says in verse 1, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them the wrath of God is complete. So obviously he's speaking about the time just prior to Christ's return. The seven last plagues are going to be poured out on mankind. The last three of them are woes, as it says in chapter 16, as we know. But then he goes forward, even past that time, to the great white throne, because he says, I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who have victory over the beast, over his image, over his mark, and over the number of his name. So image, mark, number, repeated several times. Obviously, you know that from the scripture. Standing on the sea of glass, having harps of God. You find language similar to that in Revelation 21 and 22, where it's talking about the point in time which all people have chosen God's way. They are all spirit now. They are in a spiritual dimension with which we are touched by but not familiar with, because we're limited to the physical at this particular time. So John sees the future of those who keep God's law. While he's in the present for him, because remember, he's in a vision, it's the present time. The end time is the present time for him, but then he is able to see, and I bet that that was very inspiring to him, that all of this troubling stuff that the book of Revelation mentions, it was good to have that kind of encouragement. Now, in Revelation chapter 12, and verse 12, we have, you probably didn't know this before, but it reveals to you the timing of the end. And it reveals to you the end time. We've been, you know, afraid to set dates and everything, but, you know, I can tell you that if you'll turn there, we know the time. We know the time. We can tell the time. It's very simple. Revelation 12 and verse 12, it says, therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. When the devil knows that he has a short time, that is when all of this is going to happen. So there you have it. Hope that's helpful to you in your further study. Verse 17, it says, the dragon was enraged with the woman. Now, we find another woman. It's not the woman that's mentioned in Revelation 17. This is another woman that the dragon is wroth with and upset. It says in verse 16 that the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. They know the future. They know prophecy. They know the spirit of prophecy, these individuals. But the dragon is enraged. Chapter 12 is a chapter that talks about the people of God for 1260 years or so. It depicts some of the things that have happened in church history, and we find that this is mentioned beginning in verse 13. The church, or this woman, I let it out of the bag tonight, the woman is persecuted from the time that he had been cast down to earth, and then the birth of Christ is mentioned in verse 13, and then the woman is given the opportunity to flee. We've always say flee to a place of safety for 3.5 years. That seems to be apparent, and 3.5 years is a number that comes up again and again. 42 months, the work of the two witnesses in chapter 11, 3.5 years, basically all the same time period. So Satan knows that his time is short. Now let's get back to this mark of the beast and put all together this keeping of the commandments. You know, the world has no objection to 9 commandments. Nobody argues in any society, whether it's Christian or not. No community of any person argues that it's not a good thing to honor your parents. Nobody says that. Nobody says that it's good to murder or steal, commit adultery, or to covet. Nobody thinks that. They understand these values and they realize that. And nobody says that those are good things to do, or to lie, or to, you never really even hear any comments about worshiping one God or taking his name in vain or anything else. No one argues contrary to all of those. But there is one that historically has been a thorn in the side, and that helps us get to where we want to be. And that is to understand the mark of the beast and the image of the beast and the number of his name. In 321 AD, there was an emperor by the name of Constantine. You've probably read about this individual. He was a pagan. He was a pagan king. He united east and west of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire existed now for another 250 years or so after his life. And it existed about 600 or 700, beginning, if you want to go all the way back to 500 BC approximately for the infancy of the Roman Empire. But this Constantine wrote an edict in 321 AD that set apart for the first time in history a day, Sunday, as a day of holiness and worship. Because even Christians of various persuasions, as there were many, recognized up until that time that the Sabbath was the day of rest. It wasn't until Emperor Constantine kind of codified everything through several edicts and writings and councils that Sunday would be the day of worship. So he wrote that Sunday was holy and that all work should be suspended on that day. Wait till I read some of the things he wrote about Sabbath keepers. It's chilling. It's a foretaste of what possibly could come in the future. In 325, he convened a council of Nicaea. Now, he was never a believer, except in one campaign where he was fighting against Germanic tribes, he saw a vision. Apparently, this actually happened. It's some kind of supernatural, not of God, but a supernatural vision in which he saw a vision of the cross. And although his forces were desperately outnumbered, something like 20-1, he saw this cross and he heard this voice say, "Under this cross, you will have victory." And so he had his metallurgist fashion a cross out of swords and emblazon it with gold. And that was what they took into battle, and they were victorious, at least the legend goes. But in 325, about a year after conquering the Eastern Empire and thus uniting East and West and resurrecting the combined empire, Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea and declared 4 things. Number 1, the Roman sun-day, or the day of the sun, was to be the Christian Sabbath. And this was something that was sent out throughout all the empire. Number two, rules regarding seasonal prayers, penance, and indulgences. You know, that was introduced into Christianity. It had been, they had tried to start it, remember, in Galatians. They had tried, in Colossians especially, they had tried to start this kind of penance idea and this this idea of penance, that this gets you closer to God. It was a part of the Gnostic philosophy as well. Finally won out in terms of a part of a church understanding or thinking that penance would be a way to get you closer to God. Number three, it was admonished that Catholics believed that Jesus was God in some fashion. They came to that. And that was codified under his rule. But it was only a way of uniting a bunch of pagan peoples into one, quote, faith. And four, something that you're well aware with, the Council of Nicaea codified in 325 A.D., was that the Passover would now be held on Sunday and not on the 14th of Nisan or Abib, depending on which ancient language you prefer. So it would no longer, there would be, and then eventually that would be transformed to Easter Sunday, as you know. The least regarded of all commandments is the Sabbath. So this mark of the beast has been around a long time, and that's what it is. Sunday worship originated in the pagan worship of the Roman Empire. This is what Constantine wrote in 332 when, unfortunately, there were still some stalwarts observing the Sabbath day. This is what he wrote about them. Understand now by this present statute, ye Novatians, Valentinians, Marcionites, Paulicians. Aha. Paulicians have been identified as a part of the true church of God. All ye who devise and support heresies by means of your private assemblies, with what a tissue of falsehood and vanity, with what destructive and venomous errors, your doctrines are inseparably interwoven. You get the point after you read, let me read this whole thing, but you get the point that if you're really trying to convince somebody, you really don't have to have anything factual. All you have to do is a bunch of name-calling. All you have to do is, by the power and might of name-calling and the authority of the sword behind it, you kind of convince people that your ruthlessness is actually righteousness. But the venomous errors that he's talking about are the Sabbath and the keeping of the Passover on the 14th. Okay, let me pick. Your doctrines are inseparably interwoven. Yeah, we would say that, the Sabbath and the Passover. So that through you the healthy soul is stricken with disease, and the living becomes the prey of everlasting death. Ye haters and enemies of truth and life, in league with destruction. All your counsels are opposed to the truth, but familiar with deeds of baseness, full of absurdities and fictions. And by these you frame falsehoods, oppress the innocent, and withhold the light from them that believe. Ever trespassing under the mask of godliness, you fill all things with defilement. You pierce the pure and guileless conscience with deadly wounds. While you withdraw, one may almost say, the very light of day from the eyes of men. But why should I particularize when to speak of your criminality as it deserved demands more time and leisure than I can give? For so long and unmeasured is the catalogue of your offenses, so hateful and altogether atrocious are they, that a single day would not suffice to recount them all. And indeed, it is well to turn one's ears and eyes from such a subject, lest by description of each particular evil, the pure sincerity and freshness of one's own faith be impaired. So, in other words, if I keep dwelling on your unsanctimonious methods and ideas, it could even defile my purity. Especially since this protracted clemency, I've been forgiving up until now, 23 AD. I first started this nonsense. It's 332, 9 years. I've given you enough time. I've had protracted clemency. Is the cause of some who were sound are become tainted with this pestilent disease. I've allowed too much. I've allowed you to convict others of your heresies, that's the Sabbath, and why not at once strike, as it were, at the root of so great a mischief by public manifestation of displeasure? Translation: you're going to get killed, all of you. After he died, there was a council of Laodicea in 363 AD which proclaimed, he still had this pesky problem of the Sabbath keepers going around, Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath. You can't even, you talk about public power, you can't even rest yourself on the Sabbath, even in your own private room and house. But must work on that day, resting rather on Sunday. But if any found to be Judaizing, let them be declared anathema from Christ. And when you have the state to back up anathema from Christ terminology, then the state acts on your behalf, and acts, A-X-E, on its behalf as well. The Sabbath was the only commandment that was altered by the Roman Empire. That, and of course, the Passover. Now, Daniel chapter 7 predicted, Daniel, hundreds of years prior to this, predicted that this would happen. In Daniel chapter 7 and verse 25, it says, well, it speaks of, verse 24 speaks of 10 horns. We'll get back to that later. And then it says, another shall arise after them. In the latter part of verse 24, you'll see, he shall be different from the first ones, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. A 3.5-year period, as we know, as the Bible explains. So this change in respect to time, the time for the Sabbath. Now a mark, the mark of the beast, is found either in the hand or the forehead. What's the correlation? I'll allow myself this one scriptural reference to be placed into my notes, which you don't have to turn to, by the way, so don't accuse me of going too fast. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 1. Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. In other words, this law, everything I'm giving you. And in Deuteronomy 5, we find a restatement of what? The Ten Commandments, which were given 40 years ago at Mount Horeb, Exodus 20. But this was a restatement of the law as they were about to go into the land. 40 years after, Ten Commandments, Deuteronomy 5, exactly the same, word for word, jot by tittle, exactly as it was in Exodus 20. No deviation 40 years later. They're given the same information. God says, I didn't change anything. It's the same law that you're, you know, those that died in the wilderness got, and you were just little kids, some of you, now you're over 40 years old. Those of you that have been born, here's the law. This is what you're to take into the land that you're to possess. It is a way of life to you, every single one of them, the ten. Don't deviate from any of it. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be frontlets between your eyes. There you go, on the forehead. Also I'll cite, because I want to beat that record, Deuteronomy 11, verse 18, Proverbs 7, verses 2 and 3, and then I'll turn to Revelation chapter 7, where it talks about the sealing of the 144,000, and where are they sealed? Chapter 7 of Revelation, and in verse 3, says, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of God on their foreheads." So that sealing takes place on the foreheads. Now, let's go back to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 7. Once again. Daniel 7. Let's go to verse 15. You know, all of these things were being shown. Destruction of peoples, destruction of their lives. And in verse 15, "I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me." I'll say, "I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all of this." So he goes to an angelic being. "So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things." Those great beasts, who and what is the beast? Which are four kings which arise out of the earth. So, you know, we read history. You know, I'm a student of history. You're students of history. You read about these kingdoms. You know, Babylon was the first world-ruling kingdom. And it sprang, you know, soon after the Garden of Eden, as we have discussed. And then Nebuchadnezzar became its greatest king. There were others. And then there were other world-ruling dominant kingdoms that came after that. There was Persia. There was Greece. And there was Rome. How did they become great? By the slaughter of the innocents. And Daniel is catapulted through hundreds of years of visions of nations that become great by dominating and domineering other peoples, dragging them off into captivity, cutting off their heads and piling them up into pyramids as a warning against two other nations that might dare to oppose. This is what Daniel was terrified when he saw. These kingdoms, how they arose, their dictatorial methods. We've had it even in the 20th century with Hitler and Stalin. Stalin murdered more of his own people in the 20th century than died in all the rest, almost in all the rest. It was probably about 50 million in World War II altogether. But Stalin killed 20 to 30 million Russians of his own people. Some he starved to death on purpose. These are despots. The Bible doesn't talk about Stalin, but I'm just using him as an example. 17 says, "These great beasts," because why are they beasts? Because they have the actions of beasts, guided by their primal instincts to seek out and destroy. "These are four kings which arise out of the earth." So the beast is a king or kingdom. The Bible makes it very, very plain. Yes, the Bible makes it very plain. Verse 21 says, "I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them." Now, it says of this fourth beast, let's go back just a bit. Verse 19 says, "Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast." This is the beast that's spoken of in Daniel and Revelation. It becomes the most powerful and the most prominent of all, right? "Which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, and the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. And I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom." This is exactly what Revelation 12 is speaking about, when the dragon was wroth with the remnant of her seed and went to make war with them. It's the exact same time frame. "Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue 3 kings. This horn, this one is going to rise after them, after the political, economic, military unification, then you can look for a supernatural, religious unification to fall right after that particular time with this other horn, this little horn that is mentioned here, and this other beast that is mentioned in chapter 13 of the book of Revelation. This one, this little horn, is going to speak pompous words against the Most High and shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and as we read, it changes the times and the seasons. This is a religious organization, make no doubt about it, is going to persecute the people of God. And anyone who does not have the mark of the beast is going to be subject to that particular persecution. Now, Revelation 13 covers some of the same ground there, so you can coordinate these two chapters. I know this is a review for most everybody, but the exciting way in which I've jumped around is brand new to all of you, and even to me. Okay. Revelation 13, John stands on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Same thing as Daniel saw. That's why Daniel was amazed. And on his horns, 10 crowns, and on his head, a blasphemous name. And this beast has all of the attributes of the previous beasts that are mentioned, we didn't have time to cover in Daniel. It's like a leopard, it's like a bear, it's like a lion. It has all of those characteristics. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. This beast was annihilated at one time in history. But guess what? It has resurrected full-blown in John's eyes. So they worship the dragon. They worship the devil who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who can make war with him? Obviously, nobody. Now, we don't see that arising on the scene just yet. We don't. We have a pretty clear idea of where it's going to be. But the little horn that is mentioned in Daniel is the same as verse 11, another beast. Another beast. Wow, this is another beast that comes up. I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, but spoke like a dragon. So what is a lamb in Bible typology? Christ. But it speaks like the devil. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. So we have a concordant of church and state whose deadly wound was healed. Now we know that the Roman Empire was vanquished many hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, but it came back to life. And that's why we see these successive eras of the Roman Empire, which we'll get to in just a bit. The second beast of Revelation 13 is going to cause everyone to receive a mark on their right hand, on their foreheads, and if you don't have that mark, you will not be able to buy or to sell. No one will, except one who has the mark or the name or the number of his name. So what's behind this strange-sounding practice, and how is it going to affect people as the time of the end draws near? Well, again, I've said that many have speculated about the meaning of the puzzling prophecy of the mark of the beast. As I've said, some excitedly saw supercomputers as something that would help identify everybody on the face of the earth as the mark of the beast. Personal identity numbers, cards, even the latest one, probably whenever these became available or began to be in every device, like your phone, microchips. Yeah, everybody's going to have an inserted microchip in your skull, maybe in your ear, maybe, you know, wherever. But the mark is on the hand or the forehead, which is figurative, certainly can be figurative. The mark of the beast is obviously a mark of disobedience to God. because they have accepted the beast and worshiped the beast, and so therefore are going to be disobedient to God. The seventh-day Sabbath is shown in Exodus 31, verses 12 through 17, as an identifying sign of God's people. If you have a future time in which there's a forced observance of Sunday as opposed to the Sabbath, then, as it has happened historically, it doesn't take much imagination to realize that although the Bible does not explicitly define the specific methods for which the beast will use to identify those who are free and able to participate in commerce at the time of the end, certainly the individuals who keep the Sabbath and honor the Sabbath are going to be those that do not have that sign or that mark of the beast. Now, who will be the beast? History shows that there are patterns of human behavior along with the broad outline of prophecy that can help us to forecast future events. In Revelation 17, where we have just been, we say seven kings or kingdoms. Daniel 7, as we have seen, shows these same seven kings. The first three were destroyed or plucked up, as we read, by the little horn. The Vandals, Heruli, and Ostrogoths through history are kingdoms that arose from the Roman Empire that attacked the Roman Empire, actually, but they admired the Roman Empire, and they promulgated the same kinds of policies and systems. And at that particular time, we know that the papacy was able to, and I'll use my little cheat sheet from, if any of you have the old booklet, Who is the Beast? It undoubtedly has what we have lovingly referred to as the beast chart. And this particular aspect of the Holy Roman Empire, filled in by the Vandals, Heruli, and Ostrogoths, were at the behest of the Pope destroyed. Now, that was after the fall of the Roman Empire in 476, and I'm not going to complicate things with too many dates. Revelation 17, we see that the beast is ridden by a woman or a symbol, and obviously it's symbolic or figurative language. Revelation 19 and verse 7 speaks of a woman as well. Let's turn there. Revelation 19 and verse 7. It says, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready." So wife, woman, is typical of a church. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2. Also, we know Ephesians 5 shows the symbolism between church and woman. And so there is another church which is ridden by a woman, or there's another beast that is ridden by a woman, and that woman is a symbol of a church as well. The beast is both a kingdom and a king. Now, I'd like to finish with 10 points that all last six of the empires of the Holy Roman Empire have been a part of. And you don't have to write these down, but from the time of 554, there has been the Emperor Justinian, then there was Charlemagne, then there was Otto the Great, then Charles the Great, who is the first of the Habsburg dynasty, then there was Napoleon, and then Italy was a resurrection of the Roman Empire in 1870, united by Garibaldi, all the Italian states, and then the last one is mentioned in chapter 13 as the last of these seven heads. There are 10 things that all of these six have had in common, and if history is a guide, then it's very likely that this will follow in the future. It's not a must-know. It's kind of an interesting no. It's not a thus saith the Lord. It's just that we know that history does repeat itself sometimes, and it's possible that these 10 characteristics will be shared by the future resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. The first one is they have all wanted to imitate the Roman Empire and the grandeur, and you saw the pomp and circumstances associated with the trumpeting and the lute and the lyre and everything else of the Babylonian kingdom, and a lot of that has been passed on. The magnificence of music and pageantry and, you know, marching and everything else that governments can do and military can do to make things look so great and sound so great and make people march off to war and kill the saints have been a part of all of these resurrections. There is a fascination with Roman government, and we don't see it today. We don't see it because, guess what? It's not there yet. It's not there. But a desire to imitate the Roman system. Napoleon, for instance, said, "I am a Caesar from the race of Caesars." He named his son the King of Rome, and the toga, which was a Roman garment, was an admired thing by Napoleon. Mussolini also greatly admired Rome. He had dreams of Roman grandeur. In 1936, he proclaimed a revival of the Holy Roman Empire. And Hitler, in his rallies, he sought to imitate the classical Roman system in which people would have obedience to this dictator. And he was successful to a certain degree. So we might expect the coming beast. It's hard to separate beast from human being, right? We might find that this leader who arises out of the scene of Europe at some point in the future will look backwards to the style of the Roman system. Second point, there is a goal, and there always has been the goal, of establishing a far-ranging empire. You know, if you look at a study of maps of the Roman Empire throughout history, you'll see that it started small and got bigger and bigger and bigger, and, you know, contracted at various times. But the desire has always been to have a dominant empire across much of the world. God didn't allow it to happen. Thankfully, in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, he forestalled that. He did not allow that to happen. So one ruler, one law, one church, that is the goal. Three, authoritarian rule. We know that Christ recognized the way Gentile kings ruled, and he told his disciples that that was not the way they were to serve, but they were to become servants, not dictators. Rarely has the kind of power ever been used in the Roman Empire in an enlightened way for the benefit of its subjects. In fact, years ago, Prime Minister Thatcher said, "Europe has only been united in tyranny." And that was stopped by the forces of the Israelite nations in World War II. We see the power of that is absolutely unlimited in Revelation 17, and it's going to be corrupt. The fourth thing we see is that in each time of these six revivals of the Roman Empire, there has been the collaboration of the papacy every single time. And though it's been a stormy relationship at times, which kind of predicts what's going to happen in the future, Christ said that Satan's kingdom is divided against itself. That's what's going to happen. In 800 AD, Charlemagne was crowned by Pope Leo as the Holy Roman Emperor. In 1520, Charles V was crowned ruler of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Clement. And then Mussolini entered into a concordat with the Church along with Germany in 1933. Mr. LaRavia has mentioned an individual that he met who is an heir of the Habsburg dynasty, Otto von Habsburg, who died a few years ago. He was not of this ilk. He was not of this kind. He was not of this type. But he said, "A European culture without its Christian," we'll put Christian into quotation marks, "is unthinkable." So the church, we see in Revelation, is going to confirm the authority of the beast. Revelation 17 and verse 16, though, also shows something else interesting. It says, "The 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot and make her desolate and naked and eat her flesh and burn her with fire." In the end, it's not going to turn out so great for this woman that rides the beast. It's going to be hated by the church, which is, there's been this uneasy relationship between these two beasts. This is interesting. I'm just going to put this into the realm of, you know, speculation, but it is kind of interesting that there was a vision, and, you know, maybe it was a supernatural vision by demons, who knows, I don't know, but it was a vision of Pope Pius X in 1909, and he said, "What I have seen is terrifying. Will I be the one, or will it be a successor? What is certain is that the Pope will leave Rome, and in leaving the Vatican, he will have to pass over the dead bodies of the priests. Do not tell anyone this while I'm alive." Those who are in an audience of the Franciscan Order in 1909, as Pope Pius X was speaking to them, said that he appeared to be in a trance. They couldn't move because when he rose from his seat and opened his eyes, he said, "I have seen one of my successors of the same name who was fleeing over the dead bodies of his brethren. He will take refuge in some hiding place, but after a brief respite, he will die a cruel death. Respect for God has disappeared from human hearts. They wish to efface even God's memory. This perversity is nothing less than the beginning of the last days of the world." So this was a vision that he had, and Bible prophecy says that this woman will eventually be hated by the beast. The other thing, fifth point, German domination has been a part of the last six revivals of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was carried on in history by the Germanic peoples. Charlemagne was a German Frank, Karl de Gross, or Charles the Great. His capital was in Aachen, Germany, not in Paris. Justinian was also of Teutonic origin or German origin. He's thought to be born on the Illyrian Peninsula or Greek, but research into his name shows that his family was Teutonic in origin. Napoleon, now of course he was French, that breaks the mold, right? But no, he wasn't. He was Corsican by birth. And Napoleon did not speak French until he was 10 years old. His family has been traced back to the 11th century Florentine Italy, which was settled as a Lombard or Germanic duchy. A Germanic tribe conquered North Italy and settled there. He was a German Lombard. In 1806, he crowned himself with the Iron Crown of Lombardy. Hitler dominated the sixth revival of what many think is the sixth revival, which began with Garibaldi. And of course, Otto the Great and Habsburg dynasty were also of Germanic origin. There's a Germanic legend, and I haven't looked into this too closely. It says the last emperor of Europe will be another Charles. Now, the sixth point or characteristic of the beast power is going to be an involvement in the Middle East, which the Bible well documents. And that has been a part of each of the successive six resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. They've all been involved with the Middle East to some degree. 1798, Napoleon had a campaign in the Middle East. He publicly honored Muhammad. Justinian the Great had wars with Persia and later on signed a peace treaty with them. Charlemagne was friendly with Harun al-Rashid, the Caliph of Baghdad, who ruled the Islamic world. Charles V courted the favor of Suleiman the Magnificent. Mussolini invaded Libya and then marched on to Tripoli. And Hitler, of course, tried to drive to Palestine. Prophecy shows that Assyria will be allied with the Arab nations against modern Israel prior to Christ's return. An interesting read on that is in Psalm 83, which I won't take the time for. I'm hitting 1 minute or 1 hour, 8 minutes, so I'm closing. The seventh point, despite what you see now in Europe as the configuration of the Eurozone, historically, there has been British opposition always to the idea of a unified Europe. And they have been at odds with all of these Gentile revivals of the Holy Roman Empire. Napoleon wanted to conquer England, but he was defeated at the historic Battle of Trafalgar by Admiral Nelson, and thus they were not able to take over Britain. And of course, early on, Caesar invaded Britain, but then they were called back to Rome because of local problems. But there has always been British opposition, and you can probably bet that there always will be, in the end, British opposition to a formation of a United States of Europe that is headed by the Catholic Church. The eighth point is the association with the occult. Not surprising, given some of the messages in the book of Revelation, specifically Revelation 13, which in verse 12, it says, "He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth and in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast." Thessalonians also speaks of this individual who is given great authority and power by Satan the devil. In ancient Rome, there was tremendous interest in the occult. Tremendous interest. Caesar Augustus would not step outside until he had had his horoscope read to him every day. Napoleon and his wife believed in fortune-telling. Josephine believed in tarot cards. He had numerous mystical experiences in his life. He saw a spiritual message in the king's chamber, the Great Pyramid, when he went to Egypt. Justinian the Great and his wife were described by associates as demons in human bodies. One servant claimed to have seen a strange form entering the king's body while he was asleep in his chambers. And it said that he rarely slept, ate, or drank. So where is the power coming from? The court secretary and advisor to Charles V was a magician. And we're not talking about somebody that's, doing juggling acts either. Talking about the kind of Janas and Jambres type of magician. Otto the Great, Hitler, and Mussolini all had astrologers. And Hitler's advisors claimed that at times a strange force would overtake him. And that is why at the Nuremberg trials, when these generals and people that were under Hitler were questioned, and it was discovered that they all knew that what they were doing was wrong, the primary factor in their decision-making was that they said, "You have not seen the Führer in his fury." It was an unhuman presence, in other words. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 23 says of this particular power that is going to be available at that particular time. Sorry, I just bypassed Daniel. Daniel 8 and verse 23 says, "In the latter time of their kingdom, when transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes," or dark sentences, as it may be in your King James Version. "His power shall be mighty, but not his own power." It's going to be supernatural power. Revelation 16 and verse 13 show that unclean spirits come out of the beast's power. And of course, we know that Paul said in Ephesians 6 and verse 12 that we fight against the prince of the power of the air. The last revival of the Holy Roman Empire is going to be Satan's last great shot. We can be sure that the previous six revivals have just been a forerunner of the kind of involvement of Satan the devil. Vatican Hill, by the way, from the Latin means the place of divination. Number nine, history has shown that the revivals of the beast power have been a master at exploiting crisis in order to seize power. So that is why, even though Europe is seemingly at a crossroads politically, militarily in some ways, economically certainly the biggest problem that they have, unity has never come about in Europe as a result of a natural process. All of these dictators, from Justinian to Mussolini and Hitler have seized power as a result of crisis and problems, to where people will cry out for a strong leader to solve the problems, and they will accept almost anything as long as they can solve the problems. And of course, under Hitler, the trains ran on time. We're talking about before the war. So people accept that as a compromise, even though there are many injustices that are a part of it. Powerful men have capitalized on events centering around a crisis. When there's hopelessness, when there's fear, people cry out for somebody strong. Before Napoleon, there was a revolution and terror in France, as we know. And it continued as well. Otto the Great emerged as a great deliverer. And of course, Mussolini and Hitler were able to emerge after the collapse of an economic system in the world. For many years, there's been peace and prosperity in Europe. Not recently, they're just facing the problems of their economic system and difficulty. But it is very possible that, as in the past, there could be a crisis that will allow a dictator, a strong man, to arise. The 10th characteristic that we see in all of these resurrections is God's intervention. God's intervention. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 21 shows that man can only go so far as God allows. He puts nations in their place. He puts men in the lead if he wants them there. He allows what he allows. Isaiah chapter 10 shows that God is going to intervene in the events of man as Christ returns to set up his kingdom. And you can read that one on your own, the whole chapter. Until that time, we might expect the coming beast to be a student of classical Rome, one who will be able to exploit a crisis situation, very possibly, I'm not being dogmatic, very possibly of Germanic descent, who will collaborate with the Roman Catholic Church. This man has not, to our best of our knowledge, appeared on the scene yet. But at this time, it's likely that he is alive and that he's getting ready for bed right now. Doesn't that warm the cockles of your heart? Let's watch and be prepared spiritually so that we ourselves are ready for these coming future events.